Inside Impella Transport Talks, your co-pilot for training. I'm Shane Turner, and I'm so glad you're here. As members of Abiomed's Critical Care Transport Team, we know that every transport is a lifeline, and every moment counts in our mission to recover hearts and save lives. Today, we're exploring how we can better integrate pre-hospital and hospital care to improve outcomes for patients experiencing cardiogenic shock. Joining me is Bill Halliman, Regional Clinical Manager for the Upstate New York and Pennsylvania area for Abiomed, J&J MedTech. Bill brings decades of experience from firefighting to nursing and critical care transport, and he's here to share not only the lessons he's learned, but also his vision for the future of cardiac care. This episode is about the power of collaboration, standardized protocols, and technological innovation in driving better patient outcomes. Let's talk.
My name is Bill Halliman. I'm a regional clinical manager in the upstate New York and Pennsylvania area for Abiomed, J&J MedTech.
Awesome. Thanks, Bill. We appreciate you spending some time with us today. Give me some background. What brought you to nursing as a career path? Tell me about where you came from.
Yeah. So I think, Shane, it was probably inevitable that I was going to wind up in healthcare in some ways. My grandmother was a nurse at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and my grandfather worked in the shop there. And, interesting, I didn't know this till later, but actually my grandmother had suffered a severe back injury, putting a patient in Trendelenburg and using a 4-post bed. And my grandfather actually, after that, invented the first bed jack as we know it, because, there wasn't a way for nurses to do that besides lifting a bed to reverse Trendelenburg somebody. And so, I think it always probably was inevitable. My father's a fireman. My mother's a physical therapist. My older sister's a physician. My younger sister's a medic. So somehow I just wound up picking healthcare.
I got it. Yeah, you were definitely pre-chosen on that path, weren't you?
Yeah.
So firefighting background, pre-hospital, first responder, we got the RN behind us now. How'd you find yourself in this cardiovascular world?
Well, actually, it predated a lot of that. I think, if probably any of us, I know you're not, you're young. I'm not. I grew up in the 70s. And I think if you grew up watching Emergency or MASH, I think some of these things were destined to also happen. But, right out of high school, just as you mentioned, I was in the fire service, and, I had a few events, and even my first year on the job that, probably shaped what happened and still happens today as I look back at it. And we're in the firehouse one day at the watch desk, and we stepped outside the radio room, and we found one of our fire chiefs unresponsive, apneic, pulseless on the station floor. And, I was nothing more than a teenage fireman at that point. And, this is early 90s. And, survival from out of hospital cardiac arrest unwitnessed wasn't a thing. It wasn't a choice. But, the stars aligned, single rescuer bystander CPR, no AED, positive pressure ventilation with a demand valve, late ALS. And surprisingly, we had a neurologic recovery and a survivor. And I think, that as I look back on it, probably shaped and gave me faith that the system can work. And if we put ourselves and dedicate ourselves to doing a good job, we can make a difference. Now, I think we've all, unfortunately, think about our own family and friends and other coworkers that haven't survived and patients that haven't survived. But for me, that always directed me in the direction that this can work. The system can work for patients. It can work for our loved ones. It can work for community. I think that set a framework for me to be passionate about, giving everybody a chance at a good outcome.
That's interesting stories. And you're right. I mean, full disclosure, well, there's an age gap between you and I, but there's a lot of similarities in your career path. And I don't think I've ever met a firefighter who can't claim that Johnny and Roy were some kind of inspiration at some point, right? I mean, I never did 12 leads where the patient had to have their hand in a pot of water to get the polarity right, but I've heard stories. So got your in-hospital nursing experience under your belt, but you dabbled a little bit in transport, right? You've done some critical care transport stuff.
Yeah, you know, a fair amount. So as the decades went on, and I was a paramedic as a nurse, I actually worked initially a couple years in medical device area doing clinical education for a patient monitoring company. So got to see, you know, a lot of the world, experience a lot of things. And then those things all kind of tied back together when we could no longer really travel so easily after 2001. And we're starting a heart transplant program up here in New York. And I was fortunate enough to get the position really as the first VAD coordinator. You know, this is post rematch, you know, first durable FDA approved VADs for discharge. And, you know, our romantic attachment was to start a heart replacement program, not really thinking heart recovery for these patients. But, you know, the way the system is and the way New York State is with a certificate of need state, we had big cities up here that didn't have transplant and heart recovery programs. So what did that mean? That meant that at the time we had to start a spoken hub system to move those patients in. And the other thing about New York is we don't have a lot of municipal EMS, right? So a lot of EMS is private or even volunteer still. So there are large communities, with large hospitals that didn't have the infrastructure to do anything that we resemble now as critical care transport. So we started a hospital-based transport program really around the Aviomed BVS system. And it really included even sending surgical teams out, getting patients on support, would keep the team there for a considerable period of time. I mean, I had transports that were 16, 24-hour turnover times before we, you know, we deemed the patient safe enough to move. But, you know, with that, that system progressed as the technology progressed. And not only did it, you know, allow us to develop proficiency in critical care transport, but it allowed us to carve out a little bit of a different niche than we generally are forced to, you know, act on. And when we think about transport and, you know, it's a scarce resource and the primary mission is moving the patient. And if we leave a ship on a helipad, we're taking that helipad, you know, potentially out. If we're on site too long, we're taking that resource away from a community. But the one thing about it was we were able to make it very patient centric that, you know, the nurses could spend time with the family, explaining to them where they were going in this new city, you know, talk to them about the choices their loved one may face when they get there, you know, giving them a real continuity of not only patient handoff, but, you know, even stability of the patient, right? We think now what we know about, you know, short-term impacts to intervention for neurologic events or compartment syndrome in these patients. You know, there are times where we made decisions as a team to make those interventions at the site we were at before, you know, transporting. So I think, you know, that growth in that hospital-based program specific for mechanical circulatory support, you know, changed a lot of our views about what it was. You know, we thought we were just going to transport Aviomed BVS patients. Turned out we had to actually teach them. We had to support them. A lot of times we were finishing the surgery ourselves. We had to advocate for what the patient needed on site to make them safe. And then we had to execute even just the transport to get them moved. So, you know, yeah, that was the early growth and what became, you know, a long career in transport.
That's really interesting. I mean, you've got a very unique perspective because there's a lot of R&D that goes into this, right? Like there's some foresight to say, hey, like this patient can't stay here. We've got to move them to the bigger centers. We've got to get them access to more resources. You know what? It reminds me because I've said this often and I hear this often is like critical care transport, categorically speaking, we do two things. We bring resources to the patient or we bring the patient to the resources. And based on what you described in kind of these early days, you were doing a little bit of both. So you're bringing mobile critical care to a facility that didn't have the staff or the resources or the bandwidth to be able to handle it, or maybe necessarily the equipment or training in particular cases, I'm sure. So you're there, you're a cohesive team with the sending center. Then you have the patient by yourself back to the other center. And then it's just this continuum of care. You know, and as we get out in this role, these myself and the other critical care transport trainers, it's not just that we're training transport people. Like the transport folks today, they know how to take care of sick patients, but it's really that missing link between you've got care here, there's a period of time, and then you get care there, right? And it's like that link is so vital that affects patient outcomes. So thinking back on how you did things in kind of the early days. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes in relation to like these always developing projects is like, we're building the plane as we're flying it, you know, heavy pun intended here in the air medical transport world, but like, you don't know what you don't know, and what you thought you did may have been right or wrong. So thinking back to like what you did then and kind of your knowledge of what happens in critical care transport now, is it night and day different? Are we still doing same of the original plans and things?
Yeah, I think it the theme is there. You know, just like what you said, you know, that it's not night and day, but it's how we're going about it, right? Because if you think about those early days, it was a surgical pump on a fresh post-op patient. A lot of times their chest was even open. You know, central cannulation, 4 cannulas, and in you know who knew how to take care of that patient, right? So you were taking people who did that as a specialty and training them to the transport environment, right? But we know that has risks, right? And that's a whole nother topic to itself. But now I think that's the strength of where we are with percutaneous catheter based, you know, support is we're taking that and we're making that not the issue, right? And I think a lot of what your team does is you teach them to be so comfortable with it, they can, again, continue that mission of being patient-centric, right? Because, I mean, I'll have people call me and they'll be like, oh, I just did my first whatever, you know, my first, you know, ECMO transport, my first bipella, my first impella, and they tell me all about the pump, right? Which is great, but, you know, well, how's the patient, right? And I think, you know, where we are now, we're beginning to flip that, but we're flipping it by volume. I mean, the reason you guys are, you know, just all over the country every week is because, you know, the volume and the need is there, but yet now we're exchanging that for a greater amount of people. So there's so many people doing this, but it's getting everybody that's out there to the comfort level that it's normal, right? That's what we always want. We want the easy button. We want it to just be easy. And as soon as that's easy, you know, it's more about the patient and it stays about the patient, right? That's what we want it to be. That's what we want our loved ones to have is an easy, safe transport in a timely manner for the patient. Now, you know, what has changed? I think there's some, but what hasn't changed? I think some things are forever true until we establish a, you know, some better standards is everything is still time sensitive, right? And I think, you know, we're going to debate for a long time over the next couple of years whether the magic number is 6 hours, 12 hours, you know, 24 hours. There's just a great paper that came out this week that really looked at the 24-hour mark. And you know, people are talking about the golden 24 hours. You know, I think coming from the coordination role of it, I think it's probably more like the titanium 12. Because I think even if we make a decision to do something in 12, you know, it takes a while to execute that decision, right? We got to get an OR room. We got to get an interventional space. We got to get the team together. Might even have to move the patient. You know, there's so much to be done to make it happen, right? So I think the decision point still probably is going to be in that 12-hour window. You know, and we used to talk about, you know, when we were, it was Spoke and Hub and it was a surgical program with, you know, biventricular pumps. You know, there's no one at a pathway. These were all patients that were going in for procedure. The procedure failed to get the heart going. And they were left going on to, you know, this other form of mechanical circulatory support. And that was our argument at the time was, oh, you should have a shock pathway. It was damage control resuscitation, right? Because what would happen is people would be, you know, in the operating room, slogging it out, boy, trying to save this heart. We just got to get this heart going, which you could say was a heart recovery mentality. But there's a point where you have to just surrender what you're doing and take the heart out of the picture and save the patient, right? We all know that's the principle of damage control. But so, you know, again, what's changed? Back then it was, we're doing damage control resuscitation to make it about the patient. And what are we doing now? Same conversation, but we're taking about, well, make it the shock pathway or protocol or guideline or team that we're going to get that patient on support earlier. And then fight the battle about heart recovery later, right? We're going to, then everything's still in the game. So I think those things are, you know, all the same. And on the grander scale, you know, what do I think the greatest difference will be is if we think about the historical treatment of illness, right? I think we'd say, oh, my goodness, I can't believe we used to bloodlet people. You know, I can't believe we would we would amputate limbs for ballistic injuries in the Civil War, right? I can't believe we used to do this, right? I can't believe we don't give people antibiotics now. I can't believe if a child falls down and hits their head, they don't have access to a neurosurgeon, right? So I'm waiting for the day, you know, unfortunately, I don't know when it's going to be, that someone says, oh my God, could you, you know, my goodness, can you imagine they used to take these patients and all they do is bring them to an ICU and pour bags of adrenaline in them and hope they lived, right? And because let's face it, that's what happens to most of these patients today. And, you know, someone's going to look back and eventually say, I can't believe this is what they used to do. You know, I mean, you know, everyone that comes in now, we have a way to objectify. They're in a low output state and our priority is to restore their circulation. And it seems sense, you know, it makes sense to say, but, you know, to maintain this recovery mindset, you know, is where we need to go. So I think on the micro level, you know, that's a long answer to your question that as much things change, they stay the same. And I think that the more we can make changes and involve everybody in this, just like you guys are doing with pre-hospital and transport providers, the better it's all going to be.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. But, I think what's interesting, too, is that varies so greatly by region. You know, what you're describing is a very in-tune and integrated system, right, where transport is part of the initial care and transport is part of the destination therapies. And there's two-way communication and there's, you know, there's safe patient handoffs and the clinical capabilities of the transport crew are in synchrony with what was started and what's going to be continued, you know. But you go to any other random little spot in the country and there may be huge disconnects. You may be going hours away by fixed wing, right? Or even by ground, right? Depending on where we're at, picking up at a health system that is not aligned with the tertiary care center that we're ending up at. And sometimes transport providers find themselves, I don't want to say undoing, but we take a completely different clinical pathway, right? Like our decision-making was based on the same set of data that they had, but they took it this way and we're taking it this way, right? Because we're going to be aligned with what ultimately the patient needs. So as you think back to these transports you've been involved with and the different roles that you've held, is there any like lessons learned that can be kind of universal if you find yourself working in either one of these kind of camps?
Well, I think, you know, I think anyone that's done this for any period of time, I mean, would be pretty ignorant not to say the first lesson learned is, right, it is an environment where we have to be safe. I have, and as we've done this, and especially as, you know, we as a company even think about, you know, pediatric applications, right? Even as we talk now, we actually have a very young person going on support in our region who had a you know, an unexpected event at a community anesthesia setting and is now going on Actella support, right? So I think, but yet, you know, I'm in New York, we're getting 5 inches of snow right now, visibility's, you know, less than a half a mile, right? So I think, you know, the first lesson learned is these are dramatic things for dramatic cases. And, you know, anybody that doesn't say the lesson learned is to appreciate their pilots and their vehicle operators, I think, you know, hasn't probably done it enough. I think those other lessons that are out there or things that stand out in my, my greatest hits, I guess, you know, I think we've all had ones where like you show up and you're like, I can't believe we're doing this, right? You know, I had a young lady one time that the only way that we could get, you know, hemostatic control of the heart was to actually just leave the aorta cross clamped, you know, and to put somebody in an ambulance and drive 2 hours with a cross clamped aorta, you know, if you've been there, it's just, you know, it's just mind boggling, right? I think some of the other things that stand out in my mind, you know, early on, kind of going back to that first experience of my first cardiac arrest being my own fire chief, is thinking about the way things work and, you know, the lessons we have to learn moving forward. And when I was first dating my wife, as you know, it was also a nurse, I was at Christmas Eve dinner, I think the first holiday we were together, Christmas Eve dinner at her house, and my phone rings, or her family's house, and my phone rings, and it's a surgeon out in Buffalo up here in New York. And he's like, Bill, I got this guy who's really sick. He's a law enforcement officer. He was involved in a fight, in the line of duty. He had, as we know, patients that have, you know, coronary artery dissections in this situation, they have no collaterals. They have no preconditioning. They go down hard. And, you know, he's like, I'm putting the Abiomed BVS system on him. But I don't know if he's going to, you know, we can't do ECMO. That was never a thing back then with the oxygenators we had. He's like, you got to get out here and get this guy out of my hospital, right? And it's already, you know, 10:30 at night on Christmas Eve, right? And so, you know, and so I think, you know, you look back at that and you're like, all right, you know, not only is it a personal commitment to like, you know, we are all committed. We all spend time away from our family for this greater mission. You know, we're all out there to help someone else's family. But then, you know, the clinical point, though, is, you know, so we get this guy back. You know, luckily he does, unfortunately, well enough to survive and find out that, you know, in his central cannulation, he develops mediastinitis, right? And so, you know, this is something that we talk about, all the sequelae that we get to focus on. Oh, we're worried about their brain, their liver, their kidneys, their not having ischemic, you know, injury to their gut, their extremities, not having compartment syndrome of their leg. Well, you know, back in those days, we were just happy that these people, you know, didn't get a central colonizing infection of their thorax, right? And that's what we had. So this, you know, unfortunately, we had to actually, the only choice was to explant this the cannulas in this young man's chest, hoping he'd live, right? Because we couldn't put another pump system in. We couldn't transplant him. All we had were inotropes. And, you know, luckily he lived out a period of time on inotropes, and he was able to get his mediastinitis cleared up, and we were able to transplant him, and he's living a good long life a long time later. But, you know, when you think about what we battle, those lessons are, you know, we battle all the details, right? I mean, how often do we talk about in critical care transport, oh, you know, avoiding infection control? Well, I got to tell you, you know, infection control, it has a place, right? You can't get these patients with a bloodstream infection that it's going to take everything off the table for them later on, potentially, including heart recovery, right? Or, you know, how many times do you look at a provider and they got a really sick patient, and they're not taking aspiration precautions, right? You know, one aspiration pneumonia in these patients, you know, the wheels are off the wagon sometimes. You know, they just can't sustain another hit. So I guess one of the things is I look back at some of the lessons that I've learned is that you know, all the details matter, and it's tough, right? And that's where, you know, especially with education, you know, make the easy things go away so we can pay attention to those fine details. Make the pump easy, right? You know, be comfortable, position, suction, you know, purge, you know, all the metrics you never heard of before, placement signal. Make that easy, right? Because there's so many small details for these patients that, you know, we still need to focus on. It's just not a patient with a pump, and the pump is the focus.
Those are great pointers. I think what's cool too is these kind of these hybrid units, or like the way these lines are getting blurred now. It's not so much that like the ER is your basic care and then you get upgraded to ICU and you get critical care, right? We're seeing these shock recess units, and we're seeing these critical care EDs, and we're seeing these, you know, hybrid holding areas where we can do kind of perioperative things outside the formal OR setting, right? We're doing ECPR. We have all these different things. And a lot of health systems, you know, transport is integrated into that. You know, some of these systems are staffing the transport members amongst the unit, and then when needed, they're going to transport. Tell us about your experience and kind of your role with developing these specific shock response teams within the hospital, and kind of how that blends over into transport.
Yeah, so it is interesting, right? Because, you know, I think if anybody spends 30 seconds Googling, one of the most common nursing memes or jokes that you can find is, you know, it, in the surgery world, right, it's the joke between anesthesia and surgery. And in nursing, it's the jokes between critical care and emergency medicine. And I get it. I lived both sides of the house. I ran a trauma center for 7 years. So, I mean, there was no choice but to be intimate in that whole world. But, you know, unfortunately, to make shock work, exactly like you said, those walls have to come down, right? And so one of the things, and it's always interesting the way things happened. One of the early experiences that we had with ECPR was one of these situations where somebody knows somebody and they call a cardiologist and say their buddy had a cardiac arrest. He's out on the golf course. He's being brought in. You know, Dr. Cardiac Surgeon so-and-so, could you go help him? And sure enough, you know, surgeon calls me, you know, I grab a perfusionist, we go up to the ED pre-arrival notification, right? And this is 25 years ago, right? And you know, I can't even remember the system we used. But, you know, patient comes to the door, and within a few minutes, you know, we had another cardiologist there, put in the venous line, surgeon puts in the arterial cannula, and we were on support, I think, in less than 8 minutes. And we promptly brought this, you know, fellow cardiologist up to the ICU. And, you know, we were called down to the medical director's office a while later, and we're thinking, wow, we probably impressed him. He probably thought what we did was a good thing. And he's like, what do I hear you guys did in the emergency department the other day? And he's like, well, you know, there's this thing called ECMO. It's kind of a cutting edge thing. You know, this is what we did. It can restore circulation with really just these two lines, right? And he's like, and why don't we do this for everybody? You know, everybody who watched us do this, we didn't think about everyone who's watching this go on. And like, you know, there are a whole lot of people there that all remember, you know, other patients and even family members that didn't get this type of treatment. It's like, is there a reason you're just kind of withholding this for a friend of a friend cardiologist who's had sudden death? And, you know, we didn't think about it. You know, we never even thought about it. We didn't think about it. Right. But, you know, through some apologies later, you know, we were able to think about it, and we were able to say, okay, you know, now that you understand what we do, we understand your space, what can we do to help? Right? How can we work together? How can we make this happen? And so making these teams, you know, sometimes it's a lot like that transport conversation. Sometimes there's a time to take the transport provider and make him an MCS specialist. And sometimes it's time to take an MCS specialist and make him a transport provider. And I think we have to probably get over ourselves when it comes to, you know, pre-hospital care, you know, emergency in-hospital care and critical care, and probably even definitely the procedural space. And, you know, the same way we do kind of in the trauma center, where we have liaisons to this and everybody has a practice. And we understand that there's a time when an anesthesiologist is going to get the airway. There's a time when the emergency medicine doc is going to get the airway. And we all have to understand where our roles and our expertise lies, but we have to work together and keep that patient centric, right? So, you know, maybe the critical care nurse isn't the best person to see patients in the ED, right? Because I've had cardiologists, really smart cardiologists, tell me, well, we're going to make a shock program. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down the ED when a patient comes in, and I'm going to put a swan in them in the ED, and I'm going to measure their output. And I'm like, well, okay. I mean, I've been in a lot of EDs. I'm sure there are ones out there that can do that. Not most of them, right? You know, same thing. We had a program we were working with that came up with this protocol. And they, when you look at the literature, they're like, okay, we're going to have a shock team. Every patient that gets put on two vasopressors, we're going to have a shock alert. The whole team is going to come down and we're going to save them. And, you know, they're not used to a false positive rate. You know, it's STEMI. Right? STEMI's pretty accurate. You know, you get a STEMI alert, probably something's going to happen. And you're asking these cardiac folks to work in that space, and they're not used to false positives. You know, in trauma, we accept a 70% over-under triage rate, and that's okay because it's the price of doing business, and it's the price of being prepared, and it's the price of being proficient, and it's the price of, you know, standing up the resources with the blood bank and the OR and everybody being ready. But we're not used to that in cardiac yet at a lot of places. So that's a long way of saying that a lot of this is personalities, a lot of this is respect for each other, a lot of this is understanding where we have to be and having a vision of what that looks like. Now, in my experience, what did we find that really worked well? There are kind of a couple models I think that work well. I think the first is we do need to enable our pre-hospital providers or transport providers on the inter-hospital side to communicate with respect, right? And we've kind of dumbed this down a little bit sometimes with a lot of the technology around STEMI. But we, you know, the clinical findings we use with stroke are a good parallel, right? That's a clinical exam that a provider makes, and they communicate that, you know, with effectiveness. And I think there's going to be triage triggers there that we can use, and we're going to have to validate, you know, maybe it is, you know, a couple cardioversions. Maybe it's an oxygen requirement. Maybe it is a patient-reported ejection fraction and history of heart failure. Maybe it's their meds that they're on, right? Maybe there are things there that if we bundle them together, we'll you know, it's the ROSC patient with hypotension. You know, maybe there are things in there, the presence of an ICD, right, that will tell us, okay, this should be a shock alert on this patient. you know, he just doesn't have, you know, sepsis from his, you know, gangrenous toe. You know, this is something else. And, you know, when we do that, we can then communicate to a team. And again, could be any form. You know, some places, the emergency medicine attendings are rock stars and they get it. And they're at the door in the triage line doing POCUS. And they're determining, you know, who's in a low output state, who's in decompensated heart failure, who's in a hyperdynamic state. And, you know, that this isn't an issue. They're declaring a sky level. They're communicating that through a system. And then there are people that show up and do something about it. Right. So I think, you know, that works well. I think the coordinator role in hospitals is probably underutilized currently. A lot of these roles disappeared during COVID. It's probably important, and we have to own this as well to provide some of that education to make this proficient and make this reliable. And then last, in terms of, you know, what works, I think, is consistency, right? We have a lot of institutions throughout the country that there's still a lot of variable provider-to-provider decision-making that goes on versus, you know, patients with a low output state are going to get an objective measurement. Based on that objective measurement, we're going to restore their circulation to normal in a timely manner. We're going to reevaluate and reassess what goes on, right? And there's not a lot of places that are consistent with that protocolized approach. And it doesn't need to be complex. No one's saying you have to use pump A, pump B, you know, this approach. We're just saying, you know, somebody up front has to triage this patient. Someone has to get them in the pipeline early. Somebody has to create an objective measure of their output somehow. There's lots of ways to do that. Once you have that, our goal should be to restore their output in a timely manner. Again, doesn't, you know, we can argue about the how, but someone's got to do it. And I think those are the things that will make us get to where we need to be.
I like that. I like that. You know, two almost completely different models, but I think what I'm hearing is just that the integration is key. You know, and you said something that really got my gears turning about consistency, because even across the same licensure level, so take paramedic, take a nurse, and put them at different parts of the country, put them in different infrastructures of the health system, right? Access to care, EMS systems, clinical capabilities, you know, what do these resources look like? Even with that same baseline education, and we have the same Con Ed requirements, two could be drastically different in their experience, right? Like we see this a lot, right? Like you and I share a fire service background, and how many times have we seen a firefighter who says, hey, I have 20 years of experience? And it's like, well, you have 1 year of experience 20 times because of the place you work in, you've never been exposed to anything different. And then you take that same person, you transplant them to this big metropolitan area where the tertiary center is not even tertiary, right? It's quaternary. It's whatever the word is for five, right? Like it has 247 subspecialties of subspecialties, and anything imaginable you can get your hands on. And that access to care looks so different. So I want to tease here a little bit. Spoiler alert, you know, this project that you and I are working on and the other folks on the committee is, it's not so much that you get them to the place they need to go, because ultimately they will, right? But you've compared this back to other systems, right? We've mentioned the neuro system. We mentioned the trauma system. When you suspect that somebody is having a stroke, you take them to the closest, are you ready for it, most appropriate center, not just closest, right? And that's kind of the model that we adopted with trauma as well, right? You take them to the level one. You take them to the ACS level one trauma center because that's where all the resources are. So this kind of road we're walking down and we're learning as we go is like, well, why can't we adopt this with shock, right? Because it's like what you said earlier. We break down these walls between these critical care providers and these EM folks. It's not that they know insurmountable amounts more of knowledge regarding medicine. It's just different lanes, but they all blur. Because if I have an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest or if I have an in-hospital cardiac arrest, the pathophysiology behind that doesn't change just based on my surroundings. So now we're getting out and we're getting in front of these transport folks and we're like, hey, how would you be able to tell undifferentiated shock from cardiogenic shock, right? How do you know? And even if you don't know definitively, how do you at least raise that suspicion to say, I think the heart may be the reason to blame here? You know, and then that's what we're working on, right? You and your folks, we're trying to gather some evidence. We're trying to establish some formal research on it. And then the folks on my side is like, well, what education can we provide to these pre-hospital folks to say, hey, if you have these assessment findings, or if you have this bundle of trend and vital signs plus another diagnostic, right? And maybe that's point of care labs, and maybe that's point of care ultrasound, or maybe it's EKG patterns, right? We haven't really figured out what this needs to look like yet. But if I can at least help you narrow your differential, that even if it's just a maybe, even our confidence interval, we can only land on maybe it's the heart. Let's get you to a center that has all of the resources, right? So now we're talking about influencing destinations, not necessarily get them to the hospital as quick as you can. So knowing what you know about how this kind of works within the four walls of the hospital and how this kind of bleeds out into transport, like what does your crystal ball see for the future of how these two ecosystems kind of combine and blend?
So, good or bad, all things eventually come back down to finances and affordability of a health system to do something, right? I think the mechanical circulatory support world has made great strides in advocating and defining the resources it takes to care for these patients and have a good outcome, right? Because if someone's going to truly be at a heart recovery center, there's got to be resources there, right? You're going to need people that know how to wean the device, get them back, rehabilitate them, recover them, get them into a heart failure, specialty clinic to maintain their recovery, which sometimes we know now can be more of remission. But going back to the finances, I think, a lot of people may not know in terms of the audience of the transport provider is, in the hospital reimbursement system, the highest level payment was always for transplant, right? Heart replacement and transplant. And then about, again, going old, about 15, 20 years ago, however long it was, seems forever, right? The implantable heart pump received this designation. And because of that, one of the things that happened is we centers to be able to bill for that, almost close. We're so close, akin to what you said about, the American College of Surgeons verifying a level one center, right? There had to be a verifying body that said, okay, you Turner Memorial Hospital can bill this for an implantable heart pump, and you're certified as a center to do this, right? And so then just recently, right, the implantable Impella systems or the microaxial percutaneous central heart pump, that type of system now becomes able to bill for this highest level DRG1, which, affords then, to not only, reimburse and cover the cost for these patients, but then aligns us with the mentality that there's accountability for that, right? If you're going to get this highest paying DRG, there's probably should be some accountability there. And not only that, it provides us the opportunity then to prove all these things we know to be true. And as much as I like to say, right, when we early resuscitate patients and hit whatever it is, the 6, the titanium 12, the golden 24, whatever it's going to be, right, we're going to have less organ failure, hopefully less renal failure, less dialysis, less long-time vent stays. The one thing I like to say, it seems silly, but we just need to study that the person with low output shock and vasopressors parked in an ICU bed also has skin breakdown. And if we just prove the cardiogenic shock treatment in a timely manner reduces skin breakdown, there'll be all sorts of resources for it then. But the first thing is, to answer your question, what does it look like? What's the crystal ball? Those have to align with centers getting on board and saying, okay, we as an institution are going to be a level one heart recovery center. And then, of course, we have to have those definitions. Those definitions are still growing today, right? Because, the more you peel back this onion, you realize and you do look at these other systems that do it well, there's a lot there, right? It isn't just a pathway. It's the people. It's the protocols. It's the quality assurance that looks at it. It's saying, just like we do today with these other parallel systems, that if we select this pathway, let's say optimal medical therapy for shock, and they wind up still having, needing dialysis, well, we need to look back, how does that patient get reviewed to say somebody made a decision that, and it's fine, Mr. Smith was a stage D patient, but he was a responder and he was on 2 vasopressors, but he still wound up going home on dialysis. What's performance improvement for that look like? And then even now, you know, there are centers that are now pushing the limits and actually opening shock clinics, right? Because so many of our patients are sudden death survivors, right? This is devastating for them psychologically, devastating for their family. You know, the physical rehabilitation needs are specific many times. Like, do we have, you know, physical therapy that's VAD aware that can ambulate these patients in an ICU safely? Is that not a barrier, right? So I think, you know, the crystal ball is we eventually get some clear definitions on what this looks like, you know, and then going for the transport provider, you know, we've always looked at in all these other parallel systems, right? What is triage accuracy, right? Can you and I identify that someone who's had a head injury that's hypertensive and has a low GCS, somebody needs to know, right? And that's, it's sensical to say, but you know, what is that going to look like for the patient in cardiac failure? Is it going to be, we had a POCUS? Is it going to be, what does EMR look like in the pre-hospital environment that we would know their history? What does it look like for pre-hospital labs? What does pre-hospital lactate look like for a patient that has a POCUS exam that shows low output, right? Does he go to that, as you said, the most appropriate facility? And then do we have the insurance support and the regulatory support in the states and the medical direction support to say, yeah, that's a good idea, right? And I think there's so much there. And there's probably eventually, I would hope, to be, you know, the community education, right? Think about it. You have FAST posters. You have choking posters. You have CPR posters, right? You have stop the bleed posters in the lay public space. Well, what are we going to educate people about, you know, their loved one who's having a slide and can't speak, right? Can't put, you know, four words together to make a sentence without shortness of breath, right? What is
well,
it going to...
Save the penumbra was the best one that's already been taken, so...
You know, what's that going to look like, right? So I think we're going to take all these lessons and hopefully, you know, we're going to put it together and we're going to define these centers and we'll get the advocacy and support to make it all happen.
So I'm going to ask you to be king for a day and... I had the pleasure of meeting your wife a couple months back, and she told me that you actually do this a lot on your own, but I'm going to give you permission this time. We'll have you be king for a day, okay? You're king for a day. How does transport change to play the biggest possible role? Like, what is a single or maybe a kind of a pathway of impact that transport can have to pay the biggest clinical dividends in this patient population? Like, what could we be doing that we're not doing now? And you're king for a day, and you blessed all the people of the land of transport, and now they can do, like, you think it's that pivotal that we could just change one thing and this, like, man, everyone survives now?
Well, I don't know if it's ever going to be one thing, right? Because, you know, is EMS a necessary system? Is it funded? Right. Do providers have the time to get pre-hospital education in a format that they can synthesize it and apply it? Do they get feedback? You know, I struggle with how many times crews, you know, transport have ROSC, have a good case, and they still never know, right? They never know it was a good case, right? So, but that creates passion, that creates engagement, that creates an awareness, right? So, I mean, would EMS providers have consistent follow-up on all the cardiac patients they transport in? You know, will we as EMS providers be taken seriously? And, you know, in the sense of it's legitimate to have integrated, you know, EMR communication that we can identify patient risk factors for history. Like, we know so many of our growing patient population when it comes to the need for MCS are acute decompensated chronic patients. You know, you want to take some, you want to talk about someone who's really viable to save, right? A lot of times it's just, you have to break that cycle of crisis that they're in, you know, but you know, it's such a challenge when they're an extremist to get that information and know, oh, this is their medical history. This is what's already happened to them. You know, this is probably the right diagnosis, right? And then, you know, the technology, right? I mean, how many, you know, places that are just trying to create competitive salaries for medics, right, and create longevity in EMS as a career. And then, you know, how are we going to ever get to the point where we can buy quality
point of care ultrasound, train them on it, provide them regular feedback, and make that a viable tool. Right? It's just not as easy as saying, you know, you go on company X's website today and I'm going to order a handheld ultrasound probe and give it to, you know, the paramedic engine tomorrow. It's not that easy. So, you know, king for the day, I'm glad you give me the opportunity, but I think that, like many things, we have to just treat our providers and EMS, with the respect that I think they've all earned, provide them with the tools to do their job. And then, you know, again, going back to that respect, provide the feedback that they need to do that job better tomorrow. Because we all want to do it better tomorrow, right? You know, I want to show up and it's just like we say with trauma, right? You say, are you going to the hospital or are you going to the trauma center, right? And that's not an abnormal conversation, right? And we, you know, even the news reports that differently, right? You look at the news says the patient was taken to the trauma center. And I think, you know, I want to walk in that room and see, you know, unfortunately, Mr. Smith probably tripoding at the kitchen table in an acute exacerbated heart failure and have someone say, you know, Mr. Smith, we're going to transport you to the heart recovery center. And when that becomes normal and that becomes the mnemonic, like some of these other things that are out there, I think we'll have gotten there. But, you know, at the end of the day, you need that good provider with the right tools to save Mr. Smith's life.
I love that take on it, because I was sitting here thinking, how's he going to answer this? You know, like what piece of technology, what cool procedure, what device, what instrumentation? And you wrapped it up in just something so simple as just respecting these pre-hospital providers for the knowledge and experience they have. And more importantly, like celebrating them for like actually making a difference, right? Because they got them to the place that can continue the care. You know, I wholeheartedly agree that there doesn't need to be this separation between here's your subservient providers, and now that you're in the hospital, you are blessed to do all the things that are now important, right? And that loop closure with that feedback is immensely important. I mean, I can tell you from every role that I've had, from the BLS ground provider, who all of my job was is just to drive, right? I'm not even done with EMT school yet. I'm just a first responder. I got to hand the medic a couple things. And then you fast forward and, you know, I'm in a big metropolitan fire department. I'm a paramedic and we transport these sick patients and I never hear anything back. And now I'm working in the hospital and I see these people come in and it's like, well, they're none the wiser of what we just did or what happened. Critical care air, right? Critical care ground. And it's like, but, you know, some people do get that, right? Like I was blessed to work for a service that was required. We had to give feedback to our other providers. We called the sending facility. We let that critical access center know exactly what happened. I made sure to speak with the EMS crew. You know, in a lot of these places, extremely rural, you know, so the EMS crew is also the guy that runs the Ace Hardware town, you know, in town. And, you know, we'd see him there on our days off. And, you know, I think that's an interesting spin, that what makes everything better is just, it's just cohesion, you know, it's just medical professionals treating each other that way. You know, but I think that education goes both ways. You know, I think often we hear, hey, let's make sure that the folks in the field know what we know in the hospital. It's equally, if not more important, that the folks in the hospital understand the capabilities of what these pre-hospital folks have, but also the constraints and the logistics or lack of flexibility of the environment they're working in. You know, that's the big disconnect when we go out and do these transport trainings, is it's not that I'm here to, you know, embody this knowledge you've never had access to before. I'm here to tell you, hey, I've done what you've done, and I realize that this paper says you do A, B, and C, but you can only do A. B and C are not options. So where do we go from here? You know, and I think that education is bidirectional for sure.
Oh yeah, we just we had a young lady that just in this city who, you know, presented at a community hospital, turned out to be myocarditis, got an Impella, was near circulatory collapse. You know, the RV was now going to be out, got transferred to another hospital, got, you know, ECPella. And then from ECPella, you know, young female, heart was in standstill, actually, and then transferred over to the transplant center. And then luckily has had full recovery. She's on the floor, neurologically awake, you know, explanted from everything. And just to think about everybody that's involved in that, right? Some transport crew brought her to the ED. Some transport crew brought her to the first hospital. Some transport crew brought her ECPella over to, you know, the transplant hospital. And, you know, they have to think about that. I mean, there's going to be another young person with myocarditis next week, next month. And, you know, what does that look like? And how are they developing that muscle, that brain memory to think about, all right, I've heard this story before. I know this, right? I know to take this seriously, right? And we can't have everybody learn those lessons, you know, unfortunately, the hard way.
Well, Bill, that is the end of kind of our to-do list here. What kind of note do you want to end on here? I really like the places we've been so far.
You know, I like these podcasts that kind of allow, you know, some like, what's the nugget that I can use, right? Maybe I'm a new provider. Maybe, you know, because again, let's think about it. It's going to be the technologically savvy generation that knows what a podcast is. That's going to be tied into wherever this comes from, right? So I'd imagine a seasoned provider listening to this probably knows everything we just said, right? So what is it for the new person? So here's a couple of my mnemonics for the new person, right? And I know this doesn't always work when we're in the air environment, but just remember, and none of these have I made up. These are all ones that I've stolen or been taught myself or learned the hard way, right? That one is none and two is one, right? You have to be prepared. And whether you get in your jumpsuit or you got it total stucked away, you have to be prepared technologically, pharmacologically for everything else that could happen. And when I say that, have a plan, right? And talk about that plan with your team, right? So if you and I are doing a transport tonight, it's like, all right, if he wakes up, patient wakes up, this is my plan. It's like, good with you? Yep, that's my plan. We need to give volume. This is what I think. This is what we're going to give. You good with that? We got access. Good. You know, stay one vasopressor ahead. You know, have a plan on how you're going to do that, whether you're allowed to do push vasopressors or what the drip ceilings are that you're going to use. Talk about it so you have those orders with your medical control if you need to ahead of time. You know, if a patient's bleeding or is at risk for bleeding, especially some of the patients that we transport, you know, again, how are you going to detect it? What's the plan? And for a lot of agencies, are you even prepared to deal with it, right? And if not, you know, think about what you're doing. I think there are some lost arts. We talk about this in the fire service, right? Salvage is a lost art and it changes a lot now with technology. And, you know, the other thing is temperature loss in these patients. You know, just because we're not transporting them on a BiVAD circuit, right? Just because they're on an ECPella doesn't mean that they're not at risk for developing temperature loss during transport and then having bleeding, right? One that I don't know where I got it from. It could have been this guy, Shane Turner. But, you know, the slowest, smoothest, fast is legit. You know, I
didn't come for me because it was on your coffee cup when I met you. We didn't have to hear that, sir.
You know, in my version of ADHD, that took me a long time to appreciate what that saying meant. But it is true. And I think when I look at a lot of teams, and sometimes it's corporate in terms of someone's telling you, you got to get back in service. Someone's telling you you need to be, you know, you don't burn that fuel. Someone's telling you you got to take the next job. But, you know, a lot of danger to patients comes when we go fast. And we don't need to go fast, right? And drips get disabled, pumps get air in them, drugs get disrupted, airways come out, drains get clamped, you know, things get missed, right? And so we have to keep those simple things. So I guess those would be some of my things for probably the people watching, and they're all new. And then for the senior people, one that I heard just the other day that I really like is, you know, especially now, I think, you know, not now that, you know, no one lets me, you know, in a helicopter anymore, I guess I don't need to watch my weight, which is a bad reason. But, you know, bring a cookie for everybody. Right. And what does that mean? Right. When you're out there and you're teaching or you're conveying something, right, there's going to literally be that basic medic who's driving, or that it could even be the janitor who's helping you load. Right. It's bring something to everybody. Bring, you know, make sure they understand the mission. Make sure they understand something. If you're teaching, teach to the person who's new in the classroom, who just wants to be a whatever you're teaching. Teach the person that thinks they do know everything, right? Challenge them. Challenge yourself to come up with something that's valuable to that person who has more experience than you, that's just being made to sit in the room with you. So, you know, bring cookies for everybody is what I got for you.
Thanks for listening to Inside Impella Transport Talks. We're here to support you in recovering hearts and saving lives. For more Impella Transport information, visit us at heartrecovery.com/transport. And if you like our podcast, please head to your favorite podcast platform to subscribe and give it a 5-star rating. This podcast is sponsored by Abiomed. The information, findings, and conclusions expressed are those reached independently by the authors.